health, beauty and well-being, and sometimes sex. Listen to Radio Gorgeous every day now. So today I'm in the gorgeous home of Rachel Kelly, who started off as a regular journalist, but then through having breakdowns of her own, has become a spokesperson, writer and speaker on mental health. She is ambassador for SANE and vice president of United Response. Hi, Rachel Kelly. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Oh, pleasure to be back. Thanks.
So we're here to talk about your new book, Walking on Sunshine. And I was lucky enough to be invited to your book launch on Monday, and you asked all the people in the room, and it must have been about 100 people, how many of them have had experience of mental illness, either themselves, a spouse, a relation, and a friend. Can you tell us what happened in that room?
All 100 people put their hands up, and it was a moving moment, actually, that really everybody there has been touched by mental illness in some shape or form. Because I am very interested in stigma, which I do think is alive and well. So I continued with that exercise. So what I then asked everybody to do was to keep their hands up if they had been able to be open about their experience of mental illness. And I think it was about half kept their hands up, which actually is a very good result. Normally I find in the work that I do with my workshops and talks and things, it's normally about, I don't know, a quarter or a third. And I think that just tells you that stigma is really alive and well. So half the people in that room didn't feel able to talk about their experience of mental illness, which is really why I wrote my first book, Black Rainbow, because I did want to share what mental illness can feel like.
So I want to ask, why is it still a taboo?
Very interesting. Well, I think that it isn't such a taboo in certain worlds. So just to deal with that first. So what I'd say is that in people who are suffering social deprivation, unemployment, who obviously are very down on their luck, I think there is an expectation that they might suffer from depression because people can understand that. They think, yeah, I could see that you could be depressed. I also think that there's less of a taboo in what you might call the artistic, creative showbiz world. Because again, I think there's a sort of expectation. Yeah, you know, and all credit to them, that you know, the Ruby Waxes, the Stephen Fry's, yeah, you're going to be a bit up and down. You know, that's to be expected. But what I'm really interested in is where the stigma and the taboo is in what you might call the sort of middle. Hardworking professional types, bankers, accountants, lawyers, doctors, journalists, in that world. And I think that in that world, and my experience, I've been very lucky to work with some of these firms, depression's absolutely alive and well. And stigma's huge in those worlds because, first of all, you can't see the illness. That's a problem. Next reason is that people don't understand why these people should be depressed, quotes, because in theory, they've got nothing to be depressed about. You know, they're in, you know, what are prestigious jobs. They're in employment. They're often quite well paid. And people think, well, you know, what have you got to be depressed about? Because there's a misunderstanding. And people think that depression is just about your life circumstances. And it is to an extent, and we can talk a bit more about that. But, you know, it's an illness. And it hits anybody and something goes wrong with your brain. And actually, the environment that a lot of those people are in is extremely high stress. And my experience is very anxiety driven. It's not so much low mood. My problem is doing too much. And actually, that's the environment in which those people work. The expectations they put on themselves and that the firms put on them are huge. And so I think, you know, to come back to your question, that's A, why there's a lot of depression there, and B, why there's still a lot of stigma, because there's not an understanding that it's an illness. And people think it's job-limiting, you know, if they say they've got depression.
Yes. Yeah. Can you be sacked for it? You know, or can you, if you filled in a form and they said, tell us about your illnesses, you know, should you, how honest should you be?
Well, it's a huge issue, absolutely huge issue. I mean, I don't know absolutely my way around employment law, but it, you know, in my view, it absolutely you shouldn't be sacked for it. You wouldn't be sacked if you broken your leg or if you had diabetes. You know, why should you be sacked for mental illness? But having said that, I think because people in that world particularly don't talk about it, there is a real problem. And as you say, people I talk to, often what happens is I talk to these firms and do workshops and talks. And then even in the workshop and talk, which, you know, by law, human resources departments in these firms have to take care of the well-being and mental health of their employees. And even in that context, which is supposed to be an open forum and discussion, I just find there's a huddle at the end of the talk. And people don't want to be seen in front of their bosses to say, I'm finding life really hard. And I was working with Mind recently, and they reckon that 75% of people who suffer from anxiety and depression don't get any help at all. So it's a really massive problem. It's a massive problem.
Sign up to our newsletter and never miss a gorgeous podcast again. RadioGorgeous.com.
So I know you now, it seems like such a massive problem. You've written a lovely little book, 52 Steps to Happiness. How could this help somebody?
Well, I think that I wrote the book because my first book was about my experience of clinical depression and about recovering from that. And I have recovered, and I do believe you can recover. But I also feel that it's nuanced. Having said that depression is an illness, it does happen in a context. And what I really believe is there are things you can do to look after your own mental health. And, you know, we all know you've got to go to the gym. And what I believe is that you've got to think about your mental health in the same way. And that's what I've sort of had to learn. So after my first book came out, people said, well, look, you know, you seem okay. And I said, yes, I do feel calm and I do feel well. It's taken me 20 years. I've worked very hard at it. But I've learned strategies that mean I do feel grounded. I do feel calmer. And I then started to keep a diary. I've always kept a diary, but I thought, okay, there seems to be, maybe I could share some of the strategies that I use. As I say, I run these workshops for mental health charities. So I was sharing in my groups strategies and people were sharing with me and we were trying stuff out. And so I thought, okay, I'll keep a diary of my year. What happens week by week? A tip for each week of the year, how I sort of managed more or less to stay okay. I mean, it's work in progress. And, you know, every now and again, walk on sunshine and think, yes, you know, I'm able to really now feel very, very, very differently and to feel that I am recovered.
How amazing. So what can you tell us? Gosh, it's full of practical tips. It's full of ideas. It's full of, I mean, ways of living. Can you tell me what you've done today? Come on, just I'm throwing you into it. What have you done today to make yourself feel better?
Interesting. Well, I'll give you an example. So I am a user of a lot of mindfulness techniques, which I know are very popular at the moment. Those aren't the only things I use. I've always found I needed a lot of different approaches and no one approach answers. But I'll give you an example. This morning, so I had a meeting at 9 o'clock. And I'd done the school run and the dog, and I was in a bit of a rush. And I thought, right, I'm just going to do one of my mindful activities. So the way I use them, they're just like little full stops in your day. And the one I like is washing, hand washing. And I know it's not for everybody, and that sometimes it has bad associations for other people. But for me, I just like to stop. And then I wash my hands very slowly and I have lovely soap, smell the soap, feel the water, just slow down and just enjoy that moment, being in the moment. So we know that a characteristic of anxiety is we're in, you know, we worry about the future, we regret the past, we're not just taking life moment by moment. And then the other thing I do is I just very slowly wash my glasses. Because they get quite scuzzy.
Even such a good idea.
Well, even at 9 o'clock in the morning, yeah. They can be quite scuzzy.
And you use the same soap.
Yes. And then I dry my glasses and then I just sort of have this little ritual and I just pause. And then literally I put my glasses back on and I sort of feel I can literally see more clearly. And I just do that little pause. And so I did that ahead of meeting up with someone this morning. And it just meant that I started my meeting in a very different frame of mind from the, you know,
rush, rush, bang, bang.
Rush, rush, yeah. Don't be late, yeah. Da, 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 yeah. Get there, you know. Yeah. So it's just a little way of coming down. And everything I share really are very doable. They're very small steps you can do and you can hopefully fit them into your routine. And I think what's nice is that they're all really evidence-based. They are my experience, but they're other people's experience, and their experience that, you know, we know that it really does help our brains. It lowers those, you know, causing the breathing, coming back into the moment. So that was one of the ones that I used this morning. I'll tell you another one, actually, something I've been working on. I won't go into details, but got turned down. And, I'm very sensitive to rejection. When I get rejected by something, triggers all my past rejections. And again, I've got this mantra. So I use quite a lot of mantras. And one of the ones that I use a lot is find your midpoint. So find your midpoint. So when something slightly throws you, and it did throw me, what I try to do is just sort of come back to the midpoint. And again, I often use breathing to help. And just to feel that I'm not more valid because somebody outside there has accepted or rejected something. They're entitled to their response. It doesn't invalidate me. And equally, so I'm not more special just because something goes right, but equally I'm not worthless when something gets rejected. I've got my midpoint and I'm just valid anyway, and we all are. And so I just did that little kind of philosophical, whew, come back down. Yeah, it's okay. You know, they've rejected something. They're allowed to. That's okay. And I just got to accept that.
Now, do you think we are a women's radio station and more women suffer from mental health?
Yeah.
Do you find that even in the groups you've led?
I think it's really interesting. You're absolutely right. So women present twice as often as men for depression. And if you look at all the counselling figures, I think there are around 450,000 referrals for women and around 250,000 referrals for men for counselling on the NHS. Having said that, I do think it's a little bit more nuanced because I think that a lot of men just don't come forward. So I think it may be a little bit more exaggerated. Having said that, my experience is that women are finding life hard. They're anxious and they do a lot, especially at this time of year. And my own feeling is that a lot of change has blown through in the workplace. And actually, I think employers are trying quite hard to support women. But there's not been a huge amount of change in the domestic space. You know, we may be slightly to blame as women. I found myself the other day, my husband was offering to help and I just knew I could make the fish pie three times more quickly. So I said, oh, no, don't worry, it's fine. And, you know, so I think there's a thousand sort of arduous acts of keeping the show on the road, you know, being a mother, a wife, a friend who gets the Christmas presents, orders the turkey, remembers the mother-in-law, and actually often defaults to us as women. So I think we are quite overwhelmed and I'm quite overwhelmed, and that, you know, famous old juggle. So I think there is something about, you know, we haven't really shifted our roles as much domestically. You know, we're often both couples, you know, both husband and wife are both working, but it tends to be the woman that's still doing more in the home.
Totally agree. Darling, I only listen to Radio Gorgeous. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So we're not really being assertive enough. We just think, oh, look, I'll just do it because otherwise it'll never get done. And you see a pile of washing in your teenager's room, you think, I'll do it because it'll never get done. You know what I mean? You do things because it's sort of, yeah, I get what you mean.
Yeah,
So we've got to sit down with our husbands or partners and say, let's make this more equal. Come on, let's do it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think on one level, it is about negotiating that space and how you're going to handle it together. But I do also think it's about a bigger definition of what it is to be, you know, both a woman and a man to an extent. And I think that, you know, we do wish as well to, you know, we want to be good mothers. We want to be good daughters. We want to be good friends. So we may have to look a little bit at our own perfectionist tendency as well, and you know how we may have to sort of allow, give permission both to ourselves but give permission to our husbands, because actually I think quite a lot of people find that, you know, if you allow your partner to get more involved, you know, it's lovely for them too, or it can be. So I do think we have to sort of a little bit sometimes go deeper in ourselves about, as I say, our kind of expectations of ourselves as women, and you know, just to be good enough. And that, you know, we don't have to be these perfect mothers or perfect hostesses. And I was very guilty of that, always, you know, going for the old perfectionist thing. So I think there's something there as well. about how we look at ourselves as well as how we kind of negotiate with our husbands or partners.
So Christmas is coming and it's meant to be a happy time. You just touched on it. Why do we get so fraught and stressed when it's meant to be joyous?
Yeah, I mean, it's such an interesting question. I mean, why do we do it? I mean, I suppose it's just a kind of exaggerated sort of version of what we do all year.
Yes.
But we just go into overdrive.
Gone mad, isn't it?
Yes, it's exactly. So, I mean, I think it is this split between the workspace and the home space. And it's where we sort of perhaps we feel we're our most sort of feminine and domesticated and domestic goddesses, and we want to have the nice Christmas pudding and we want everybody to have a great present, and you know, we wish to kind of be the, there's a lovely bit in Virginia Woolf actually in To the Lighthouse, and there's a scene of a kind of festive meal, and it's all about how she wishes to kind of make everything okay for everybody. So I think there's something there about, you know, just allowing ourselves again to just, you know, we're good enough. You know, we don't always have to keep pushing ourselves. And there's probably something about how commercialised a lot of stuff's become. So everyone's got a Christmas party and there's the carol concert at school. And, you know, a lot of, you know, the diary just gets jammed even if you did nothing at all. There's just a lot on. And I think that sense of overwhelm, and that's a really, you know, rich breeding ground for depression and anxiety. So I like this idea of always just sort of remembering we're human beings. You know, we're not human doings. Mm. You know, just to sort of, again, not always doing, you know, just come back to being, give yourself those spaces.
Radio Gorgeous, online, on your phone, on a podcast, or on your tablet. Listen anywhere, anytime. So, Rachel, we've all had bad days. How can we sort of go to bed at night and think, how can I be kind to myself? Can you give me a tip?
Yeah. Well, just to put it in context, I just think a little bit of understanding about the brain can be really helpful on this one. Three parts of the brain, the amygdala, never know how you pronounce it, but the fear or flight brain. So we'd see a tiger and we'd run. We've got the cognitive brain in the middle, the doing brain, getting things sorted, all those to-do lists. And we've got the compassionate brain. So that's the mammalian brain. And that's about developing self-compassion to ourselves as a way to being more compassionate to others. So I think sometimes with that idea of being kind to yourself, or in a way, often when we're stressed, we switch between the two other brains. So we're fearful and we do stuff. We do stuff, we're fearful. We're fearful, we do stuff. And actually, remember, we've got this third part of the brain. And to just reconnect with that brain that is compassionate. And so the way I tend to do it is I've got a few little mantras that I use. And so three things I often say to myself: find the strength within. So a bit of self-belief, find the strength within. You can handle it. I like that one. Don't react. So if there's a lot of stress around us, we tend to kind of, you know, be very, and the more anxious we get, the more sensitive we are, and more quickly we react. So again, come back to your authentic self, and you can control your reactions. You can't control the reactions, nor should you, of those around you. They are entitled to reactions. So find the strength within, don't react. And then the third one, which I really, really believe in, is do whatever it takes in the circumstances, whatever you can manage to make life a little bit better for Josephine today. And just allow yourself a little moment, whatever pleasure it is, even if it's just stopping on your walk to the tube and smelling a late flowering rose. Just give yourself that little pleasure. Oscar Wilde said, simple pleasures, the last resort of the complicated mind. Because I don't really think you can go out there and grab happiness. You know, I've called the book 52 Small Steps to Happiness, but I think it's a byproduct. You know, if we create an environment in which, you know, which we're calm and steady and allow, we can then kind of receive a lot of the happiness that's out there. You know, I think there's a lovely line in the Raymond Carver poem, Happiness, and he said, happiness, it comes on unexpectedly. And I love that. Just to give yourself, you know, do whatever it takes to just make things a little bit better in your day, you know.
I'm getting such positive vibes off you. My whole body's really vibrating.
Oh, I'm so excited. I have to say, I've gone quite goosebumpy.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? We're connecting, aren't we?
It's just happening now, yeah, in this moment. That's all there is.
I feel quite
moment.
Emotional, actually.
Oh, thank you.
So, Walking on Sunshine, 52 Small Steps of Happiness by Rachel Kelly is published by Short Books. Thank you for moving, Radio Gorgeous.
Oh, thank you. It's an honour and a pleasure.
This is a Radio Gorgeous production, produced and presented by Josephine Pembroke and edited by Melissa Ward.